I'd never want to look back at this thing and say, you know what, this didn't happen because I didn't give my maximum effort. Because that's the only thing ultimately we can control.
Flex Lewis, you're straight out the lair. Sean Merriman, welcome to Straight Out the Lair.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to have you, yeah. Obviously, you're such a regular here at the Dragon's Lair. You're a very early starter at the Dragon's Lair. You're one of the first guys in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so impressive to me because I see you traveling here, there, and everywhere, and you're consistent as the day is long. Every day here. What time do you come here? What time do you stay here?
I try to get here before 7. Give me an hour and a half in. Try to get done by 8, 8:30. And then I'll leave here a couple days a week, and I'll go to Extreme.
Yeah.
And then I'll get some mitt work or some cardio over there. But I'm pretty consistent, about 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You working with Eric over there?
Yeah, he wants me to work more with him. He got some big guys coming in, so I'll try to pop in when he got some big guys in there.
Yeah, speaking of Eric, literally an hour ago, I told him I had you as a guest. He's like, such a good dude.
He's one of the best, man. Yeah. Me being a former athlete and seeing the guys he worked with and his approach to them, and I always appreciate guys, coaches, and people around it that treated you more as a person than whatever you did, a fighter, football player. And Eric is just one of the best guys around in how he goes about his business and how he treats his guys.
Yeah, truly. I've linked in hard, obviously. He's a co-host of the show sometimes, too. We would have had him here today, but selfishly he's doing stuff with these fighters in Miami this weekend. I guess there's a UFC fight going on or something.
Right, yeah.
But no, talking about MMA and touching on that subject, obviously I have a massive passion for that world. And as you mentioned, the Extreme, and Hugh, obviously as a fellow athlete now, has transitioned into the training aspect of things. But you also have Lights Out Fightly. Yeah. So tell us about that.
I got into the MMA. I got back into MMA between 2005 and 2006. So I was training at Jay Glazer's gym, Jay Glazer Fox Sports. And I grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, the DMV area. And there were a ton of boxers. My uncles were professional boxers, so I naturally just grew up boxing. And one day in the gym, Jay said, hey, I think you should try out. This was like MMA was just coming on mid-2000s. And he said, I think it'll help your football with your hands and being able to being a better pass rusher and use your hands. And at that time, believe it or not, even though I just came off of a big rookie season, defensive rookie of the year and Pro Bowl and all that stuff, I wasn't really that great with my hands. I was just bigger, stronger, fast than everybody. I would run around you. I'd run through you. And so he texted me an address, Jay Glazer did, and I showed up to the gym the next day. So I walked in the gym, and this is in L.A., and Jay Glazer's on my left. And Randy Couture is on my right. It's like you walk in there, you have a lot of testosterone, big and all that stuff. But then again, it's Randy Couture, right? And Randy's still peak Randy Couture back then. And I looked at Jay and I said, hopefully you don't think I'm fighting Randy Couture today. That's not happening. But what he did was Randy got me in the very first day I started training and showed me how to pummel and use my leverage and grapple and things like that. And I could not understand for the life of me why I'm obviously bigger, stronger than Randy Couture. I got about 60 or 70 pounds, but we're pummeling, and he's just moving my body around. And I couldn't understand. And so I actually picked up on that a lot, and I used that. 2006, I came out and led the league in sacks because I got really good with my hands. So I started to train every offseason with all the guys, Tito Ortiz. I think Tyron Woodley was in there. He was just coming on around that same time. Chuck Liddell. Got a chance to train with some of the best guys around. And 2018, I ended up launching Lights Out Extreme Fighting. And so I've been in the TV side of the NFL Network, Fox Sports, ESPN, so I understood how TV worked. And so I said, okay, I know the sport. I've been around these guys for 17 years almost. I understand how TV works, production and trucks and how to operate that side of it. And I said, you know what? I can do this shit. And I launched Lights Out Extreme Fighting, and we're now on Fubo TV, Fubo Sports.
Yeah, congratulations. What is the second year, third year? What is it?
Yeah, this is nine. This is LXF 9 coming up.
No, with Fubo.
Oh, with Fubo. Yeah, we're going on our second year.
Yeah, congratulations.
Fubo, appreciate
it. Incredible.
And it's cool because we have having a TV partner change the – a streaming partner changed the game for us, right? Because now people can not only see us in the country, but our last fight was shown in Canada, France, and some parts of Spain. And so now it became more of an international, global thing now. And I'm getting calls from people all over the world. Hey, you got to bring Lights Out here. And I'm like, damn, that was crazy.
Yeah, that's gone full circle for you, obviously. As knowing and understanding how these athletes work and the mentality that goes into everything, and having a passion for MMA, you set this up, and now this has taken its own legs. You said it's number 9, right?
Yeah, we came up. This is our 9th show coming up. And our last show, we actually broke into Fubo Sports' top 10 most watched all time.
Wow, congrats.
And appreciate it. And that's, for me, that's the fun part of it, right? Because I'm just a natural. I just like work. Yeah. I like working, and I like the process of everything. So to see all this stuff coming together and the growth, it makes me want to just keep going and pushing a little bit harder.
Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, the Lights Out, the name Lights Out.
Yeah.
But I want to take it right back to where that name came from. Tell us a story of actually before all that, how you got into football and how that lifestyle chose you, or you chose that lifestyle.
That lifestyle chose me. So I grew up in Maryland, and where I came from, it was a lot of big basketball players. So like within 20 minutes from me, Kevin Durant, Michael Beasley, Nolan Smith went to Duke and played in NBA for some time. Allen Iverson is probably like 30 minutes or so from me. So I grew up around basketball players. So I started playing basketball first, but I started to foul out the games as a kid. And so the coaches said, you know what? We got a sport for you that you can't foul out. You can do this shit somewhere else. So I said, what's that? And they said, football. So I'm 11 years old, and I don't really know too much about football. And I asked my coaches, I look at him 11 years old and said, hey, what do I do? He said, you see that kid right there with the football in his hands, go hit him.
Wow.
And that was it. And I said, that's all I got to do?
Yeah.
And I went my very first play, and I just laid this kid out. And so it was natural for me. And the nickname Lights Out came about my sophomore year in high school. And so I knocked out 4 kids in 1 game.
Four
players.
Knocked out.
Knocked out. They left the game. First guy, the fullback, had a broken collarbone, and he blacked out, and they had to carry him off the field or whatnot. So it was 4 guys that 1 game. And after the game, I had about 20 students come running up to me, and they said, man, you knocked those guys' lights out.
Oh, shit.
And I said, oh, shit, okay, hold on. They called me Lights Out. And not knowing how that was going to pick up, but this is pre-social media.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to school on Monday, and I got my books in my hand, and my book bag on my back. And they said, man, a good game, Lights. And so everybody's calling me Lights. It spiraled that fast. I went home that day, and I ran to the room. My mother had the door closed. She's in there smoking a cigarette, and I'm in there waving. I said, Mom, look, I want to get a Lights Out tattoo on my right forearm because everybody's calling me Lights Out.
How old are you then?
I'm 16.
Okay.
And the smoke finished clearing. She took one more puff of the cigarette, and she said, blew it out. I said, boy, get the hell out the room. Boy, get the hell out the room. And I went from here to like down. And so me being me and how persistent I am about everything, every day for 2 weeks, I came home until she finally let me get the Lights Out tattoo on my right forearm. And so that's where the sack dance come in from when I'm doing that, flicking the light switch on and off. And so it just took a national turn.
Got you beat by a year. I had this on my at 15.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Being persistent, asking my mother too. So I just turned up at the tattoo artist and said, hey, I'm 18. He said, your mother's consent. I went up the street, wrote my own letter, came back, and I had it in this guy's kitchen.
So she didn't know?
I turned up with it on my arm.
You got some balls, because I was terrified of my mom. I would never.
So was I, but I hid it away. But either way, for you, obviously, having the upbringing in Maryland, was that one of the reasons why you stay close to signing with that college and not go on to sign with Penn State or another college of that nature?
Yeah, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. So when we grew up, D.C. was the first place in the country that the crack cocaine epidemic hit D.C. first. And at that time, man, D.C. was like, I think, top 5 or top 10 murder capital in the country. And in fact, like 5 minutes down the street from me, one of the neighborhoods was listed on that list. And I grew up in a tough environment, and we were homeless when I was a kid. So what happened was my mom couldn't afford the pay the lights and electricity, the bill. And she lit a lights, gas, everything's off, and she lit a candle because we couldn't see in there, and it was cold also. And said, I went to my mom and said, hey, I want to go stay at my friend's house down the street because the lights are off, it's cold in here. So just my mom and my sister was in the house. And I got my friend's mom got a call at 5 o'clock in the morning, and she said, come home. Hmm. And I said, what's going on? And she said, the house is on fire. It's burned down. And so I left my friend's house. He lived a couple miles away. So I didn't even ask for a ride. I took off running and I ran a couple miles home, and I got home and half the house, you can see through the front, it was burned.
Oh my gosh.
And so at that point, we went to motels and shelters. Me and my sister, my mom, we slept in the back of the cars. And so I think that period of time when I was going through something, football became like an outlet.
Yeah.
It became an outlet for me. And my demeanor and everything that I had, I was like taking out all this aggression for those 2 hours in practice, or those 2 or 3 hours in the games. It was my outlet to help me cope with everything that was going on with us at home. And so it just became my identity. I just started to play this way.
But you still went home to a shelter. You still went home to a motel.
Yeah.
Still during that time of progressing in that element of football.
Yeah. And so, and by the way, that was the second time our home had burned down.
Come on.
It is crazy. The first time our home actually burned down is when I was 11 years old. And me and my sister was at the babysitter's. My sister's 2 years younger than me. She was 9. And my babysitter at the time had witnessed a murder in our neighborhood. There was 3 triplets, brothers, who had murdered someone in our neighborhood. And my babysitter had saw it.
Oh, wow.
And so while we were there, there was about 6 or 7 kids who she was taking care of. And I just remember this loud shattered glass breaking. And they threw one of those like cocktail bombs where you light the cloth and you threw it.
What's it called? Cocktails.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the brothers or whoever it was had threw it through the glass in the whole place.
This is your house.
This is we lived upstairs, but it was the same building. So the whole building had burned. And the unfortunate part about that is we all got out. My sister got out and the other kids got out. But the 1 4-year-old girl burned to death in her sleep. I mean, she never woke up. And so it was a crazy time because you don't realize how traumatic that is at the time when you see it, because you're so used to being in that environment and just seeing crazy shit anyway. But at that time, to see a 4-year-old girl can really mold you in certain ways that you don't know just yet. And I didn't realize that until I got older.
And you have your own family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that some of those things growing up happening, it really gives you like an extra layer of skin, right? Where, you know, certain shit just don't bother you. You're fine with whatever. But yeah, it all starts at that young age.
Where was the breakthrough for you?
I think, so when we lost the house, when we lost our place the second time, my high school coach ended up taking me in. And so I lived with him. This was after my sophomore year. And I think it was probably the first time in my life I had a regular childhood, right? Came home, the lights were on. I didn't worry about eviction notice being on the door. We had food. I remember actually the first day I moved in with my coach and he had all this cereal. So I remember he had cereal and cookies and everything. And I ran through everything.
Every flavor.
I had a bowl of everything he had in there. And it's because it was my first time actually experiencing normalcy and what normal was. So I think that was the first time I started to look at everything different. And you look back on like, man, we were really in a shitty situation.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know that at the time.
Do you still have that poor man's mentality? Because obviously when I mention that is I had an upbringing too, very humble upbringing, nothing obviously like yourself, but elements of electric going off and stuff like that. And there's a lot of firewalls now built into my life that will never take me back to times like that. But still, I have these moments quite often where I'm reminded that, right of my upbringing, that feeling of nothingness and the strive of trying to break through. Do you have many of them days right now?
All the time. And I think the biggest part in how that helped me moving forward with everything that happened is you can endure a little bit more than most people, right?
Yeah.
This bad day might be their car didn't start, right? Or they can't find their keys and they missed a late for work. Yeah. Like just something of those. I said, no, you don't know a bad day. Trust me. You come home, you got an eviction notice on there, your lights. So you don't know a bad day. So somebody else's bad day wasn't my bad days. But I do have those times now where that hunger, because you came up a certain way, that part of you never leave. Now, you transition and cope and deal with it a lot different. It will be able to use it as fuel, because at that time I was very angry.
Yeah,
I was very angry. Man, I would literally ask. I said, "What did I do to as it's happening. And you learn how to go about things a lot different and use it more in a positive way than you do, like I did.
So when your coach took you in, because I'm a mentalist, I love this stuff, did you feel like he molded you into the person you are today? Was there a transitional period where, because, you know, you look at Mike Tyson when he got taken in by Costa, and he came in off the streets. He was rough. He had this mentality, the street mentality. Everybody's heard Mike Tyson's stories. Incredible. Did you have, is anything relatable in that sense? And also, how hard was that transition coming from where you were into now living more of a stable lifestyle?
It was very similar, actually, because my high school coach was also a teacher at the same high school. And so I used to have to go and do everything that they did. So when they got there at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, I had to go there at 5:36. When the rest of the kids were getting there at 8, 9 o'clock, whenever school starts. When practice was over and they were watching film and breaking down film with the practice, and I didn't go home. I stayed there. And so it instilled this, this when we talk about being consistent and just that work ethic where I was just doing more than everybody else.
You're
always
a consistent student.
Yeah.
Watching tape when your teacher's watching tape, when the coach is watching tape as well, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so that was my breakthrough in having a regiment and consistent, being accountable, because I was working as the other players, but I also had to do what the coaches did. And I had a job, too, and everything else. Right. So I think at that point in time, that was when we talk about breakthrough, it was around that time period.
And the same thing going to college?
Yeah. And so after having a big junior year and the year that I had, University of Maryland had offered me, or verbally offered me, and I committed as a junior. And so I had scholarship offers from every big school in the country, but because of where I grew up and how I grew up, I wanted everybody around me to see me play. My coaches who took me in, my family, my friends, my teammates, everybody came. They were at the games.
That's amazing.
And at the time, I was the first Division I player ever to come from my high school. And so that was like another breakthrough. It was like, okay, cool. I put a whole school on the map. And after that, now you had guys going D1 every year.
You set the bar up high for everybody. It's motivation for everybody who's coming through. Yeah. That looking, oh, it's not going to happen to me. Nobody's pioneered the way. And then you've done that. And then in your college years, transitioning from where you are into your college, do you have elements of slipping off, or were you so focused?
No, I was focused. I was still wild. But I was one of the ones who would go out and go have fun or whatever, but I was there at 5:36 no matter what.
Go you.
Yeah. And I used to have coaches or teammates would pull me over to the side. I'm like, man, we just... Don't get me wrong, I'll be in the huddle smelling like tequila, but I'm there.
Yeah,
and I had that about me. But also, too, man, I was very regimented.
Yeah.
And I'm still. I've always been that way. Been consistent. And just I had this mentality to always outwork, because, as you just said, I did have that fear of going back. That was enough motivation for me to go and press on as hard as I did.
So staying local, I want to tap on it before we talk about the NFL and stuff, but how did you stay focused and not allow people from the past to distract you? Because you're still in that same area. Yes, you've got the good people around you, but you still have people from old trying to get hold of you. Now, Sean Merriman's a name. He's a face. People want to attach themselves to that. Oh, I remember you back. Remember, you forgot where you come from. How did you stay focused?
Yeah, and that was a huge problem for me, to learn how to move on, because you have that survivor's remorse, right? You're the one that made it and they didn't. And then when you start transitioning out and growing up and doing things better, some of the people you grew up with don't like it, because that includes cutting them off.
Tall poppy syndrome, we call it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I dealt with that a lot, especially being in my own backyard. And that's why I was so happy at the time that I didn't get drafted by the then Redskins. Because I'm like, go to college there. And I said, no, I can't do it. I said, anybody draft me but the Redskins. And was fortunate because I ended up getting drafted by the Chargers.
Yeah. First round pick as well.
Yeah.
Incredible. Obviously, you had high expectations for yourself. And what was that expectation for you going into your first season in the NFL?
So I came in with a lot of hype. This kid coming in, I was the youngest drafted. I was drafted at 20. I was the youngest drafted, I believe, at the time ever. And coming in, you got this lights out nickname, and I came in with the jewelry on and the glasses. I'm from East Coast, so that's where we big earrings and watches and all that. And came in with a little bit of a swagger, and sometimes it came off and rubbed some of the older guys the wrong way. And I remember coming in, and you got first of all, I walk into the locker room. You got LaDainian Tomlinson, Antonio Gates, Phillip Rivers, Lorenzo Neal. You're talking about guys that are Hall of Famer and some of them future Hall of Famers. Yep. And so they wasn't about to call me lights out. No. They would call me Rook or 56.
Really?
Yeah.
And you have to earn the stripes.
You got to earn your stripes. And remember LT telling me that. And the first thing I started thinking in my head is like, okay, I got to get you to call me lights out. And that happened my rookie year against the Chiefs when I knocked out Priest Holmes.
Yeah. So talk me through that. Because I have a very similar story, but I want to hear, obviously he's calling you Rook. He's calling you your number. Where was that moment of you hearing it for the first time?
It was, so I came and I held out. So now I got all this hype. I held out. Now people looking at me like, who the hell does this dude think he is? And yeah. I was so pissed off, man. And me, I find any way to fuel something so I can do more, anything. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing it in the press, some of the teammates like, oh, he needs to be here. I said, the first day I get there, I'm laying somebody ass out. No. Somebody's getting laid out. Yeah. And I did. I got there and started hitting guys, and I started earning my respect on the field. But we went and we played the Kansas City Chiefs. And I'm out there, I'm playing at linebacker, and Priest Holmes, which was one of my favorite players of all time. He played for the Ravens, and I grew up watching Priest Holmes. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And so I go out, and I have this big hit against Priest Holmes. He's out. He's not. He's asleep for two commercial breaks. He's out.
Come on.
And unfortunately, he never really played after that, so I did feel bad about that at the time.
No, you didn't.
I take that back. I didn't. Yeah, I tell you, so Marty Schottenheimer, who was the head coach.
Yep.
And this is why I love, and I miss Marty to death, because he was tough as nails. He was hard. He was old school. We're in practice. We would have four pads taken to the ground tackling. We're tackling in practice. Yeah. And I hit Priest Holmes, and I'm excited. I'm jumping up around. I'm talking shit. I'm just yelling, screaming at the top of my lungs. And I got there to the sideline, and Marty Schottenheimer had grabbed me by the face mask. And he said, Sean, that was a hell of a hit, but don't forget this guy's family and his friends are watching.
Ooh.
And I'll never forget that moment.
Yeah.
Because it put everything in perspective for me. And I said, oh, shit, that's right. Someone is, and he's down. He's really hurt. And, yeah, man, but that day, that play after the game, I remember LT coming up and shaking my hand and called me lights. Wow. And it felt good. It felt good to have somebody like Danny to appreciate that.
Yeah. That going back to what Coach said, what a sobering moment, though.
Yeah.
A sober moment of celebration and thinking you're going to get more flowers from the coach, and then he's, hey, come down to earth.
Right.
Yeah, man. Did you celebrate with that in mind? Because obviously you've got an incredible celebration, which I want to talk about too, which became synonymous to you. Every kind of have copied it. Fighters have copied it. So many different people have copied it. Kind of like the Conor McGregor walk has been copied. You had your own celebration style copy too. But where did that come from? And also, after that moment, did you have certain people that you didn't give a fuck about celebrating with that style, and then certain people you downplayed with?
Yeah. My freshman year in high school, my high school coaches, they said, hey, do you want to see a real linebacker? He's a freshman or sophomore. They said, do you want to see a real linebacker play football? And I said, yeah, I want to take me to go see whoever you're talking about. They wouldn't say what. So they took me to a Ravens game. And I believe this was the 2000 Ravens when they won the year they won the Super Bowl. And we didn't have any money. My coach didn't have any money. So we sat way up in the stand. Like, you can change light bulbs from where we were. You could turn around and fix a light bulb. Just one of them went out. We were way, way up there. And they're announcing all this team. They had all these great players, Tony Siragusa and Sam Adams and all these, Bobby McCray. And everybody was coming out. I'm sorry, not Bobby McCray. Jamie Sharp it was. And last but not least, Ray Lewis came out. And mind you, the place is already electric. This is the hottest team right now in the NFL. And they're introducing the defense. They all come out. And you heard this big pause. And then the smoke and fireworks came out. And everything got quiet. And all you heard is, it's getting hot. And Ray's out there, came out dancing. And you know what's funny about that is I used to watch those Michael Jackson, like, shows and when he's performing, and I used to see people passing out all the time. Man, he's a person. What's wrong with you? It's why you pass. And so at that moment, I knew what that feeling was like. I knew why people were passing out with Michael Jackson, because when Ray came out, I felt lightheaded. I was like yelling. I said, I've never seen anything like that when people react to anyone that way that I've ever seen in person. And so I looked at my coaches, my one coach's hand looked at me. I said, one day people are going to react to me like this. And I told him that. And they did. And so what I did was my rookie year, I requested for me to come out last in the tunnel.
Jeez, really?
Yeah. And
wow.
And I just turned 21, and I took on this leadership of vocal mm-hmm. role as being like the spark plug for the guys, get everybody going. And I requested for me to come out last, and I did. And that's first time I did it, it went crazy, and I've always come out the tunnel last from that.
Was that first time, was that any resistance from the OGs? Or they signed off at that point in time, knowing you were the future?
Yeah, it was a little bit, but everybody knew I was like the next up.
Go ahead.
And so there was a mutual respect type of thing. And we did have a guy who normally came out last who was older. He's been in the league 7-8 years. And I even that day came and he broke down the huddle for 5 years. I came in that day and I started breaking down the huddle.
At 21?
At 21, yeah.
Still a rookie?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
You've put such an incredible impact on the sport from a very young age. And obviously you've had an incredible career. But even just that, just hearing about that as a rookie, there would have been, in many teams, probably resistance,
yeah.
no matter how good you were. So they recognize, and kudos to the OGs and the people who have been playing,
yeah,
and the coaching staff, just to allow you to naturally, organically take that leadership, take that role, knowing what you were then and soon to become, yeah. by allowing you to grow into that position. Incredible.
Yeah, much respect for them. And it was a lot of support, man, so I appreciated that because they didn't have to. They could have all banded together and got older guys got together and said, hey, who does think he is?
Yeah.
But it was, I got a lot of support. But also, too, you're in that position, you got to live up to it.
Yeah.
It's almost like having a nickname like Lights Out. Like, people wanted to kick my ass going. And I had friends on other teams, and they would come back and tell me, say, the coach said, I don't give a shit who makes the play today. Don't let him do that dance.
Come on.
And so it was week in and week out, we're a target.
Yeah.
And I like that. Yeah. I like that, being in that position. He always had to go out and live up to that persona.
Just staying on the rookie tone for a second. Obviously, you had the start to there where you just mentioned and ended. You must have some crazy rookie stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. San Diego, 21 years old. But
one's for the podcast.
Yeah,
I guess,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I know you're deciphering which one we can talk about.
Yeah. No, but I tell you, the craziest one, when we talk about the OGs and the older guys coming in. So we used to have this thing called the rookie dinner.
Okay. Have you heard of them?
Oh, yeah. So the rookie dinner, if you're a first round draft pick, you had to take out all the vets who were 4 years and up. Right. So if you were on the team for 4 years and up, you had to take out everybody.
It's an expensive dinner.
Oh, you're telling me. And so we went to this place in San Diego in Del Mar called Papa Moose Grill, which is a very upscale, like, steakhouse. Okay. Very expensive. And I've spent some money already. I got my contract. I spent a little money, but on cars and a house stuff. So we go to this dinner, and everybody's having a great time. Drew Brees is there, and Antonio Gates. Like, it was for the first time you started to feel like you're with everybody else. It's like you're welcoming in. And so they're ordering all kind of food and alcohol and all this other stuff, whatever. So I'm like, man, I'm just happy that everybody's having a good time and it's on me. And they're like, hey, I'm falling into the bullshit, right? Yeah, I'm having a good time. Not knowing what's to come, right? So I saw Drew Brees. He got two big bottles of wine, right? I'm 21 years old. I don't know what wine costs. I'm thinking at the liquor store, what, $50, $75?
Oh, my God.
This is a $1,000 bottle of wine. He got three of them. And so I'm sitting there with Antonio Gates, and where he orders a bottle of alcohol, and he says, I said, hey, what's that called? He said, oh, this is Louis XIII.
Oh, man.
So
at a restaurant too.
Yeah, mind you, I don't know. I'm having a good time. I'm taking all the vets out, and we go through that bottle. Me, him, Jamal Williams, and like two other guys, we ran through this bottle. So I said, man, that stuff was good. I want another one.
It's good.
And so Antonio, you grab my arm. He said, hey, are you sure? I said, yeah, man. Bring it. So then we go through three bottles of that. So we sitting there, and everybody was wrapping up. And the owner of the restaurant, he comes and taps me on my shoulder. And I said, hey, what's up? He said, yeah, I need to see you in the back.
Uh-oh.
Well, I said, what? We're done. Just bring me the check, and I'll take care of it, whatever. He said, no, I need to see you in the back. And I'm looking at him at this point. I had a couple of drinks. I'm like, dude, just bring me the damn check. Bring the check. Let me just, please, Sean, come in the back. I said, okay. I get up. I go back there by the kitchen. And when I tell you he whipped out a grocery store receipt from CVS or whatever, that dropped.
Yeah.
All the way to the ground to my feet. And so I'm lifting this receipt up. I'm lifting all the food and alcohol. And I look up. Look, I got to the bottom of it.
$32,336. $32,000?
Yeah. And...
$32,000 what?
$32,336 or something like
that's
that.
That's a number you never going
to get. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget that number. And so I said, okay, I'm looking at it. I'm like, is it $3,000? I'm looking at this thing wrong. I had a couple of drinks. I'm like, I'm going by item. I said, wait, we didn't order.
Yeah, we pulled out the asparagus.
I said, you forget it, whatever. And I gave him my black card, and they swiped. And I was hoping that American Express called me to decline it. So I offered to wash dishes or something in the back. They didn't. It went through. They didn't even call me to check and see if it was fraud or anything. I said, please, for the one time that I was somewhere, I'm like, please decline. Please decline. And it went through. And I just remember the sick feeling I had after paying that bill. But one thing that did, in a way, make the situation better, LT stood up on the chair in front of everybody and was just talking about how much they're going to need me and rely on me this year and helping them go to the next step. So ultimately it was okay. But for a week, man, I was pretty sick about that.
Oh, that's a rough number too. I couldn't even imagine. And this was still obviously you were into the season now, obviously going into the season. Obviously,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, $32,000 dinner. I couldn't even imagine. Have you been able to repay that back to anybody else? Any other rookies?
No, I kind of stopped it after that. I kind of stepped in and put a stop to it because it's too crazy.
And the bar was going up, was it?
Yeah, it was going up. And so I think that we started to split it up between all rookies or something like that who came in. So it wasn't just on the first round guys. But the first round guys still paid the majority of it no matter what.
Talking on that subject of change, how do you see the NFL different now to when you were playing?
You can't hit nobody for sure. But one thing I will say about this, and I hate the old school talk, right? You see the old school guys come in and calling everybody soft. Or the game not like it was back in the day when we played leather helmets, and don't like that talk. I do appreciate the NFL doing more about the concussions, right? The helmet to helmet, those type of the crack back blocks where you can't see a wide receiver come down or hit you helmet to helmet. So I appreciated that part of it. What I don't like about the game now is you're trying to, like the taunting stuff, they've gone overboard. Right, it's a very emotional sport, hitting the quarterback in certain areas, and it's a flag. So it's kind of taken, for me anyway, it's taken the fun out of some of it because I just like to go out there and hit guys, and that's why I played the game. I literally, when I was, I had my first big interview after my sophomore year, and I was ranked on ESPN in the country, and I had no media training or anything like that. And a reporter from ESPN came up and asked me, he said, what made you get into football? Why did you start playing football? And I looked at him as, I don't know anything. I said, hey, I can do anything I want to anybody and not go to jail. So when I tell you it was like the most awkward
pause,
it was like, the guy looked at him like, this guy's going to jail in some years, man. Yeah,
the writing's on the wall for this guy.
Yeah. He's off his rocker. And I didn't understand what I said until I got more familiar with media and how things work. But dead serious, I told the reporter, I said, hey, I can do anything I want to anybody out here and not go to jail. And I got into the game because of the physicality of it and the competitive part of it. And it was a very masculine, violent, brute sport. And I love that part about it. So I think that the NFL has taken away some of it, trying to protect too many guys.
Oh, yeah. Is there anything you'd like to, from the athlete standpoint, implement into the game or you'd like to see?
As far as on the field?
Yeah, on the field.
On the field, I think that for me, there's so much technology out here that if they wanted to look close to certain things and not have it to be such a big onslaught or whatever, like holding calls and things. Like, you have cameras out here who can catch all of this stuff if you really want it to. So, yeah, I think that. But all in all, man, the game of football is so damn exciting to everybody. I don't know how much you want to start tampering with different things to change it.
Yeah, like the game of rugby has changed significantly. They've softened it up.
Yeah.
Compared to the games that I played, obviously, when I played high-level college before transitioning into bodybuilding. But, you know, what I loved about playing college was there was no third referee. You could get away with a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I got a lot of scars on my hand from teeth. I've also got fake teeth from being on the receiving end, too.
That's right.
But the college was a lot of fun for me because of the kind of the purest element of rugby. There's a lot of brutal aspect to the sport, but there's also a gentry side.
Yeah.
After the game, I would say, like, you and I bugged it out on the field, I would send a pint over to you in the club, and we toast, even if you're missing a tooth that I've knocked out, or vice versa.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a massive gentry side to the sport of rugby. I've noticed also in NFL nowadays, compared to what I've heard and read and things I've seen of old, the teams stay loyal to the teams. There was maybe friendships, obviously, outside of that. But now everybody's friends in the offseason. We have so many teams of players who train you as in the offseason. We've got guys who play for the Chargers, next to guys who play for the Giants, next to et cetera, et cetera. So back in the day, is that a big change too?
It's huge. Not that part of it I can't really relate to. And don't get me wrong, I had friends on other teams. And sometimes in the offseason, I'll go to their charity event or they got a golf tournament or what, I'll show up and I'll be there to support. But for those 60 minutes, those four quarters, I hated you.
Yeah.
And I wanted no part in. I had a friend who played running back for the Cowboys at one point, and we had a preseason game, and I was out there just trying. When I've known him for over 10 years, and I was out there trying to rip his damn head off. And you would have never gotten – my family knew his family and vice versa, and I said, during these four quarters, these 60 minutes, I don't know you. You have on an opposite color helmet. You're on an opposite team, and I'm going to do whatever is necessary to win. And – I think that aspect, you see these guys now, jersey swapping, and that, to me, don't get me wrong, if Tom Brady or Randy Moss or like a big guy, you would love to ask him for a jersey during the offseason. But it was no buddy system after the game was over on that level.
Got you. With the fame, I wanted to touch on this too again. With the fame that you acquired from a very young age, 20, 21, then going into your seasons, that came with a lot of responsibility, obviously, on the field and also off. How were you able to navigate and stay mentally focused with the women that are coming out, trying to distract you, and all these opportunities? How were you able to, season after season, turn up?
For me, nothing was ever going to affect what I did on the football field. That was always number one, right? So I'd laugh and joke about going out and drinking or having fun or whatever and showing up 6 o'clock in the morning, first one there, last one to leave. I've always been that. But nobody can really prepare you for that life. We used to have a three-day seminar when you got drafted where the NFL walk you through all these things to look out for. Family and girls and this. And
really?
Yeah, so they will keep you in a hotel, whether it's in Florida or California, for 3 days, and it will be like 6 to 8 hour days, and they're just drilling you on all the things, bad financial advisors, people to come and take your money, how to tell your family no, and all these things. But they can't prepare you. They can tell you about it, but they really can't prepare you for what's coming because they talk about family. What do you do? And that was probably my biggest and hardest thing to do is tell my family no and people around me, because I naturally wanted to take care of anybody that I possibly could who I love. And so I had to get to a point where I start telling my family no and not feel guilt-tripped or feel bad for not doing it. And so if you get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning from a family member and they're about to get evicted and your cousins are there and you hear them crying in the background, and what are you going to do?
Oh, tough.
Pay the rent, right? But what happens when they need rent again? You pay it again. And at some point in time, you have to cut that off. So I had a huge, that was probably my hardest thing to do, is tell my family no, and I took care of all of them. The second part of it is, as far as the girls, is you're 21 years old. And I got friends, obviously, who didn't play sports or whatever, and the shit they were doing at 21, you couldn't do. So you always had to watch out for it, but you're still 21, so you still fall into that trap at some point in time. And I think that me being focused and being consistent and wanting to be the best on the field always brought me back. So everybody falls off that track, and you party a little bit too much, you're hanging out with too many girls, or bad crowd. But I think for me, it was always the focusedness of wanting to be the best on the field that brought me back no matter what, because it's only but so much you can do when you show up at 6 o'clock in the morning every day. Yeah. And even still now, man, 6 days a week, I'm up 5:30 in the morning, I'm here. And that part of me is never going to change, but it was difficult because you can't really necessarily prepare anybody for that.
Yeah, especially in the girls, because you're trying to be, you're at legal drinking age.
Right.
18 is the UK, so we start pushing at 15. Or you probably start drinking, pushing the board in college. Come 21, you got this covers and on ESPN, you're talking, you've got all these people telling you how great you are, and then you have an influx of, there's no DMs there, but you have an influx of women just throwing at you. And coming from the environment you were brought up in, all of a sudden you've got girls that maybe that, oh shit, I used to look at you on the fucking, used to be on my wall on the poster. Next thing you're in my, not in the DMs. But that's fucking tough. I'm sure, listen, if I know what I would do in my shoes, but, and I'm sure I know that you've done in your shoes too.
Listen, I partake, and it's funny you said that, because the most ones that were on my wall I end up getting.
I'm not going to ask you to kiss the time. Don't worry, my man. Don't worry.
Yeah, if you're on my wall, you're in my place. That's at awesome. Some point in time. You kind of expect somebody to go through that at that young age. Mm-hmm. In fact, I almost preferred to happen early on because by the time I got 24, 25, I was hip already. I was mentally sharp. You've already been there, done that. So you start in your mid to late 20s, tapered down from all that stuff, where the normal guy is starting to get money and stuff in his late 20s, early 30s, starting to get some success, and then they experience it then. I experienced that. I was a millionaire at 20 years old.
It was hard to balance finances at that age?
Not just hard. It's almost impossible, right? Mm-hmm. Because for one, many people are going to tell you no. Because everybody's looking for their job or be secure. Very few. So if I wanted a car, I go get it. I had an SL65, a Phantom, a Ferrari 360 Spider, I think it was. Yeah, so I had seven cars. All at once, yeah. And so no one's really around to tell you no. Now, your advisors or whatever say, I don't think you should. I'm going to do it anyway.
Even if you did.
Right. I'm going to do it anyway. But I got that out of my system early. Right. And so now I don't even crave those things anymore. Like, if it's not going to benefit my next 10 years, it's not important to me.
What would be a life's lesson for you to tell the upcoming guys transitioning from college into NFL, looking at Merriman now and where he is in his life? What would you say as a lesson that they should follow a blueprint on?
I think that take everything slow, right? Because the first thing that happens especially when you get that kind of notoriety early on, is you start getting pulled in so many different directions, right? I have publicists, and this person over here want me to show up for this commercial and this party, this event, ESPYs, especially early on, you trying to do everything. I want to do everything. When I talk to guys now and I say, look, focus on the main thing, make the main thing, and that's on the field. And so keep that number one, and then have a structure where put your foot down and you create these barriers to all these people. And don't let all these people have access to you, because they're just going to spread you thin. And so you just got to take it slow, learn how to say no. That no has to be your number one thing that you learn. And I mean, to your family, to your friends, to people trying to get you for appearances or get you to show up. You have to learn how to say no. And it took me a little bit to learn that. But now when I talk to guys, I say, it took me 4 years, 5 years to learn this. You better, day one, learn it.
Thanks for saying yes to me on this podcast.
We've been trying to do this, man, forever. Yeah. So we've been talking about it.
But I do want to say, though, Matt, like you, we've been trying to do this for a minute. You're right. But then I realize why it's not happened. You just showed me your schedule yesterday. You just showed me a schedule today. And you asked me before jumping on the podcast, it's like, how long do you think we're going to wrap for this? And I said, and I'm like, okay, let me just move this over. Today's schedule, every hour, every 30 minutes is all logged in.
Yeah.
And that's like that every single day.
Yeah.
And how hard is it to stay on track with a schedule that's so critical to ticking off the personal brand, the businesses, and also lights out and everything else that goes into the day-to-days?
It can be overwhelming, but I always say this thing, don't ask for hell and complain it's hot. Like I created this schedule. And in order for me to get to where I want to be and where I want to go, I have to be on this schedule. And it's funny you said that, because I was in San Diego. I was looking at a location. We were looking at a place, Sequoia Casino, to have a fight there. And I'm sitting down and eating. And I can tell a group was waiting for me to get up so they can take a picture and autograph. And I love being around.
You love your fans.
Yeah, man. I love. That's one of my favorite things to do. But we're talking about the schedule. And so I had 28 minutes to eat, right, before I had to walk out to do a call into a radio show. And I can tell these people just waiting for me to get done so they can. And I'm in my head, I'm like, I got a minute, 29 seconds before I had to call in.
Yeah.
But that's 7 days a week for me, where I'll have 6 to 8 radio shows. I also have a life insurance agency.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have a life insurance agent.
I wanted to bring it up, but yeah, tell us about that.
I have 221 agents in throughout the country. And then since I'm the owner of Lights Out Extreme Fighting, I'm in charge of our production team, our operations. We have 67 people in-house. So I'll get on a road and I'll go and drive to a casino and negotiate the venue deals.
Personally.
And I'll negotiate I got us to deal with Fubo in a partnership with Fubo. And so sometimes I even step this fight we're having coming up May 6th. If we can't get a fight done, I'll get on the phone, call the manager. I'll call the fighter. I'm like, man, come on, let's get this. What do we need to do? How do we make this happen?
Sean Madden is on the other end of the call. I'm sure they're moving things around for you, my man.
I'm fortunate because if I pick up the phone, I'm at least respected in that way and saying, look, this is important to me. What do we have to do to get this done? So when you wear that many hats, I'm okay with it. I'm completely fine with it. Sometimes when you've seen a schedule, but everybody doesn't know that.
Yeah, it's packed.
And the people who don't know, they don't understand what goes on the back end of this. I had a Zoom this morning with a Sports Grid at 7 o'clock a.m. That's the only reason why I wasn't here, because I had to Zoom at 7. So you guys open at 4 or 5 o'clock here. And so a few times, if I have a 7 o'clock Zoom, I'll be here at 4:30.
I've seen you doing interviews in the Dragon's Lair background.
Yeah.
Which I love, by the way. Yeah. I love you doing your Skypes, all your kind of interviews in the gym.
Yeah. And it's really, I'll carry my laptop somewhere. The other day, I pulled off the road after a meeting with Saquon, and I set up a Zoom at Carl's Jr. So you couldn't tell from the Zoom because it was a glass and stuff in the background. But I'm in a corner at Carl's Jr.
Eating the burger, randomly.
And that's, for me, that's life, and I enjoy it.
You're making it happen at all costs and making sure that the show continues. No pun intended. You are the face, and literally you are the guy that makes everything happen. So there's a massive responsibility for you to do what you do and also open other opportunities in other fields. You mentioned that your insurance company. You obviously got other elements and you've got other businesses. We have so many mutual friends that I do business with and you do business with that have kind of connected us in a crazy way. It's like I've gone to business meetings before, business dinners. The next thing, Merriman's popping up, fashionably late, all styled out. He's reserved his center spot at the table. Who's sitting there? That's Merriman's spot. Don't sit there, Flex. No, but we do. We have a lot of business in different things. That in wrapping up the podcast, my friend, what is the future for Sean Merriman? And is there anything else you want to tell your fans and anything you want to promote?
Yeah, for me, man, I think that it's important to maximize what you can do. I mean, I was just when the podcast and I was doing something else when I was promoting the fight and they were bringing up the UFC and these other promotions. And I was just at the PFL show the other day as well. So I got
in Vegas.
Yeah, relationships with different leagues and promotions and stuff like that. And we're not looking to compete with anybody. Like, I just want to maximize everything that we're doing. And I really look to maximize every part of my life that I possibly can in every way. And I'm full throttle like all the time because I never want to look back at this thing and say, you know what, this didn't happen because I didn't give my maximum effort. Because that's the only thing ultimately we can control. You can't control anything that happened in life. You got to just take the punches and keep moving along. Bad shit happened to all of us. And it's not really what happens, it's how you react to it. So I never want to look back at this thing and say, there was a stone I left unturned and that's why I wasn't successful over here. And for that, and then obviously Lights Out Extreme Fighting, with these growing numbers we have with Fubo Sports and some of the things we're doing, I want to be up in the mix and talked about with the bigger promotions. And so in my head, I'm like, okay, what do I have to do in order to do that? Is it 8 interviews a day, 10 interviews? And the fight's May 6th we have in Burbank, California. So anyone out there that's in L.A., May 6th, definitely come and check us out. We'll be at the Burbank Marriott Event Center. You can get your tickets at lightsoutxf.com. And we'll be live on Fubo TV, Fubo Sports. But we want to be mentioned up there with the best, and we want to be looked at as one of the premier leagues in the country. And I'll do whatever I need to do in order for that to happen.
I know it's definitely in conversation. As we've got mutual friends and everybody's excited to have athletes fighting on your card. You're giving fighters incredible opportunities over a Lights Out. And of course, with the growing brand and the synergy you have with Fubo and that platform alone, just both of you synergistically are blowing up together, man. I'm excited. I'm going to be at probably the next up-and-coming fight. We've spoken about it. For everybody who is watching this, we're going to put all the links below in for you guys to see. Where you can pick up tickets, all the information. One more time, repeat what it's going to be at and date.
Yep, Saturday, May 6th at the Burbank Marriott Event Center. And you can get your tickets at lightsoutxf.com, because a lot of people show up, and we're like right now, half of our cage seats side are sold out, and I would say most of our GAs are sold out, and we're still a month away from the fight.
That's incredible.
For us, it's fun. I love being in this position because I love to see growth, man. You love to see the process and everything start to pay off. But for me, it's look at the end of the road. I just look at, hey, how can we maximize today and get everything out of today? How do we do it tomorrow? How do we do it on Friday, Saturday? So, yeah, we have – the truth be told, we have the next up-and-coming, like, superstars of the sport. I guarantee you three or four of these guys on this card alone – will probably end up at the UFC at some point and probably end up being a superstar.
That's exciting, though, to see, I'm sure. Just to be the promoter and say, that guy is going places.
Yep.
And give him the ability to have that first platform, nurture him through, and then go on to other things. But knowing that he started in Lights Out is incredible, man.
Absolutely. Incredible.
My man, Sean Merriman, the man that has an incredible freaking schedule getting off here. I know he's got a radio call literally in the next
right now.
2 minutes 40 seconds.
It is so funny. I know. It's 2 minutes and 58, but
but I see in how this guy works, it's massively inspirational how you've taken fucking an incredible career, rookie status, something many things I can relate to, from the upbringing all the way through now to transitioning into where you're at now, into business. And giving platforms now to other athletes, also representing you and the brand in so many different ways, my friend. I'm honored to have you at the gym. Nothing but fucking motivation. And I'm excited to see the future and everything that you're doing.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it, man. Thanks, seriously. Thanks for having me on, man. You built a big platform. So anytime I get a chance to go and talk and promote, it's helping the cause for sure all the way around. So I appreciate it.
One of the greatest to do it. Sean Merriman, Flex Lewis, straight out there. Out.